better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi folks, this is Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't. Coming to you once again from Hot Springs Village, Arkansas, high atop the Highway 7 Ridge Line from TSPN, the Survival Podcast Network headquarters. Today is October the 5th, 2011. It's a Wednesday, and we're going to have episode 756 today. We have a special guest waiting to come on the line in just a moment, Mr. Carl Derringer of market-ticker.org, Market Ticker. Really a guy with a good track record of calling bad things in the market, and today's not going to be one of those uplifting episodes. I'll tell you right now, it's going to be some somber stuff, and it was some reinforcement as to why we prepare, and I'll have Carl here in just a minute. Before we do that, though, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors. They do a lot to help take care of you. Sponsor of the day, number one, Backyard Food Production. That's Marjorie down there south of Austin. I'll tell you what, if you want to know how to turn your backyard into a food production machine, and that's what I mean, a food production machine, then Marjorie's who you need to get in touch with and get the DVD, Food Production Systems for a Backyard or a Small Farm. Marjorie's done just that. She's taken her little rural piece of land down there and turned it into a food production machine. Something that provides them well over 50% of their intake and then, you know, allows for barter with other community members and goes even higher than that. And something that if she really had to, they could hunker down and provide for themselves for a very long time in a self-sufficient manner. And she can show you how to do this portions thereof, depending on what you want and what you have available, in anything from a tenth of an acre backyard to a 10-acre spread to a 1,000-acre spread. Her system is entirely scalable, and the heart of her system, the garden and the rabbitry and things like that, are really on only about 2 acres of land, even though she has, I think, close to 100 or something like that. So if you're looking for a system that'll work for you, no matter how small or large your piece of land is, check out Food Production Systems for a Backyard or Small Farm, available at backyardfoodproduction.com. Next up today, MERS Radio. You know, I love MERS Radio because it allows me to have a security and secondary communication system in one around my homestead. I have these motion detectors out at different areas, and, you know, if somebody or something goes by one of those areas, I'll hear alert zone 1 or alert zone 2 and up to 4 different zones. And I can actually cover, you know, instead of just 4 spots, I can actually cover 4 sectors by using multiple motion detectors set to the same zone. So I know zone 4 is maybe out by the shed or something like that. This is great because I'll know if someone's coming onto my property at night unannounced or if just visitors are showing up that I'm expecting and anything in between. I also have that secondary method of communications. The big thing with MERS Radio and MERS-radio.com, our sponsor, is that Rob over there only has a small select group of equipment. He knows it cold, and anything you're trying to do, he'll either tell you, here's exactly how to do it, or this is not the system for you. That saves you a tremendous amount of time to have that level of expertise and customized service. So check out MERS-radio.com. Remember, best way to find all of our sponsors, go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on a link. Next up, remember, connect with me, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. I will be Facebooking a lot of stuff from the Expo, just like I did last time. No vacation this time from the Seattle Expo, folks. Just business in and out. But I am looking forward to meeting many of you out there. That kind of leads me into my next big announcement. Please remember, Friday and Saturday of this week, I will be in Salt Lake City, Utah at the Self-Reliance Expo. You can learn more about that at selfreliancexpo.com. Come on by. I'll be doing a keynote speech 5 p.m. each day. So later in the evening, they're holding my talk for. I think that'll be great. And I'm going to be doing the same two that I did in Denver. So unless you were in Denver, it'll be new to you. Modern survival, building a modern survival lifestyle and gardening without water. The watering one is awesome. I think everybody in Denver was blown away by it. I'll be doing that one on the Friday. All right, next up, remember, the way we pay the bills around here is with our sponsors and with the Member Support Brigade. And Member Support Brigade is really the bigger way that we do that. Member Support Brigade is the way you can support the show, volunteer. voluntarily at 20 cents an episode, and then you get a great return of investment. You get discounts from 29 different vendors. You get over $100 worth of free ebooks. You get some really awesome benefits. You get every episode of the Survival Podcast ever published, convenient downloadable zip files, and again, you're supporting the show. Once in a while, I hear from people saying, you know, I feel guilty that I listen to you every day and I'm not an MSP member. Don't feel guilty. It's not, that's not the way it's designed. I did the show before for almost a year before there was an MSP. I did it because I wanted to turn it into a business, and I wanted people that had the means and wanted to support the show to have a way to do it, and I wanted them to be able to get something back for their money. I didn't want it to be donations, you know, put a PayPal, please make a donation to me, like I'm, you know, asking for a handout. So I put together a real product that really helps people save money. And that's what MSP is, and if it works for you, great, and I'm happy to have you as a supporter. And if it doesn't work for you, fine. Be a listener, enjoy being a listener, and tell other people. That's just as valuable to me. Every new listener is so important to the show and the community and growth. There's room for everybody. Nobody need I don't even get it sometimes. Like, I get some people that cancel and say, well, I'll stop listening. God, no, don't do that, please. Also remember, you know, if you are a firefighter, Peace Corps member, U.S. military service, prior service active duty, law enforcement officer, anybody like that, that served at the national level, I do have a special national service discount for you. Email me before you join at jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. And I will give you that special discount code. Just tell me, you know, what your job was, where you served, that type of thing. All right, with that, we've got the housekeeping wrapped up. All right, folks, as I said during the introduction segment, we do have a really cool show for you today. I have Carl Derringer on the line, who is the founder of MarketTicker.org, and it's actually market-ticker.org when you look the site up. Mr. Derringer is the former CEO of MCSnet, a regional Chicago area networking and internet company that operated from 1987 to 1998. MCSnet was proud to offer several firsts in the internet service space, including integral customer specified spam filtering for all customers and the first virtual web server available to the general public. Mr. Derringer's other accomplishments, including the design and construction of regional and national IP-based networks and the development of electronic conferencing software, reaching back to the 80s. He's been a full-time stock trader since, actually trader of all things, I think, since 1998. He's the author of, as I said, The Market Ticker, located at marketticker.org, a daily market commentary, and the operator of Ticker Forum, an online trading community, both of those since 2007. In 2008, he received the Reed Irving Accuracy in Media Award for Grassroots Journalism for his coverage of the 2008 market meltdown, something we are all very familiar with. And Carl, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Hi, how you doing today?
Man, I'm glad to have you here. I guess a listener got in touch with you about coming on. I was really happy when I saw you come in on the schedule to get you on the air. Big fan of your work, man.
Well, thank you very much.
So, I mean, we have you on the air today to talk about basically the, as you call it, the ongoing market dislocation and the upcoming meltdown. I don't think anybody here is going to be shocked to hear that I agree with you that some sort of meltdown is on the way, or maybe even we would call it in progress. But I guess all eyes are on Europe right now, and I think a lot of people are listening to the TV screen and going, well, yeah, didn't we do that last month or whatever? Just bluntly, how bad is it over there, and what can or will come next, and can we expect to see it really come here other than the peripheral we've seen so far?
You have to understand that Europe is a huge source of general economic demand. So when you look at where economic demand comes from, where the consumer comes from that drives the economy of the world, you have two major sources of economic demand in the world, and one is the United States, and one is Europe. Having the European banking system fall apart is clearly going to be a highly disruptive event simply for that reason. What you have going on over in Europe right now is essentially a repeat of what happened in the United States in 2008-2009. It's not a surprise. We did not learn our lessons in 2008. Most specifically, we didn't stop the banking system from lying about the quality of the assets that they're carrying on their books. And therefore, you get back to the old position that we always know what the liabilities are. And in the case of a bank, that's deposits. Nobody makes a mistake as to how much money they have in deposit in a bank. But you don't know what the assets are worth. Therefore, you don't know whether or not the company is, in fact, a going concern or whether it's broke. And this has become a major issue, as the market says that these bonds of countries like Greece are worth 50 cents on the dollar or less, and yet the banks are saying that they're worth 80 cents on the dollar. And one of those two is correct, and one of those two is wrong. And in one case, everything is not great, but kind of sort of okay. And in the other case, given the inherent leverage in these institutions, which has not been materially taken down, they're all smoking holes. And so, you know, there's a binary outcome kind of event going on here right now. And unfortunately, you're seeing the same kind of violent swings driven by rumors that we saw in 08 and in 07, for that matter, here in the United States. Those of you that have followed the market for any length of time probably remember that in 2008, the thing that would happen was, you know, the market would be down 200 or 300 points on the Dow, and then Charlie Gasparino would come on CNBC and he'd run some rumor that AMBAC was saved, or Buffett was going to buy the world, or the Korean Development Bank was going to make a, you know, multi-billion dollar investment and save everybody, and the market would skyrocket 200 points in 15 minutes. The same kind of thing is going on now. We were way up this morning when we opened, and now the market is kind of blah. The NASDAQ tech stocks are down as I speak. The S&P 500 has given up most of its gains. And so you have the same kind of thing going on. Yesterday we were up 150 points. We closed down almost 200. So this sort of back and forth thing where everything is rumor that either the world is ending in the morning or, on the other hand, everything's going to be okay, is you know, the yin and the yang that that has been going on. And it's going to continue until the truth comes out. So we will eventually find a resolution. The problem is that the market, in the end, is almost never wrong. All right, I mean, you have a country here in the form of Greece that we now know lied about their budget deficits and their fiscal situation to get into the European Union in the first place. This was done with the active cooperation and assistance of major international financial institutions. Nobody has gone to jail, just like nobody went to jail for subprime. And yet, at the same time, we now have these banking institutions, which, by the way, many of whom were in on it, bought up all this debt thinking, oh, you know, we'll flip this over and make a big, fast profit. And as in reality, what they're doing is they're going to take a big, fat loss. Whether or not the money's there to cover that is the open question, and that's why you see the wild gyrations.
And I just want to point out for folks that maybe you're looking at market pricing today and wondering if it matches, and it might, because it's been doing the same dadgod thing, just like Carl said, day in and day out. But this interview was recorded on the 29th and is probably being played for you on the 5th, so there's a few days lag in there. So anything catastrophic happened, we didn't leave it out. It's just a pre-recorded interview. But you're mentioning Europe there, and you mentioned Greece a couple times, and Greece is all I ever hear about. I turn my TV on, Greece, 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 Greece. And I guess that's where the most critical, acute problem is right now. But didn't the TV just tell me that the Germans are coming, yeah, and they're going to fix everything because they know how to manage money, yeah, and it's all going to be fine, right? I mean, don't worry about it. Germany's got it. They agreed. They signed off on this, and they're going to save the world. Or is that another one of these, you know, wishful, what does Mike Gaser call it, a wonderful fiction?
Yeah, that's really where the problem comes from, is that the European banks are even worse in terms of transparency and being able to believe what's on their balance sheet than American banks, if you can believe that. I've said since 2007 when I first started looking into this, that's what prompted me writing the ticker and getting involved in this project was the fact that Washington Mutual was paying dividends out of money they didn't actually have. That's a very cute trick. they were counting, and this is legal, but they were counting as actual income what's known as capitalized interest. In other words, if you have a negative amortization loan on your house, an option arm, and your balance is going up every month because you're making only minimum payments, that goes onto the balance sheet as an increase in value for the bank because the value of your loan is going up to them. Okay? This, of course, presumes that you're going to at some point pay them.
Sure.
And by the way, house prices stopped going up in 2006 in California, which was where the bulk of their portfolio was. And in 2007, they were paying dividends out of this phantom money that I had no reason to believe they would ever get. The regulators did absolutely nothing about it. And so you had, you know, and ultimately, 18 months later, of course, the bank failed. The problem in Europe is that the same sort of game has gone on here, but we don't know the scope of the damage because we don't have any kind of straightforward reporting. So I cannot take a look at, for example, Deutsche Bank's balance sheet and tell you what I honestly believe that bank is worth. But I can tell you what the market thinks. So we'll just take an American example. Bank of America has been selling in the $6 range now, $6 and $7 a share for quite some time. That's about a third of their alleged book value as measured by what they file with the SEC and what they put out to investors. Now, if in fact their book value is three times what the market says their total enterprise value is worth in the open market, then if there's anybody out there that has money, and there are people out there that have money, right? I mean, you know, let's face it, there are some wealthy folks out there, right? Wealthy countries, sovereign wealth funds, et cetera. If there was anyone that believed this book value was real, they would immediately buy all of the shares on the open market. They'd just go into the market and start accumulating stock, buy it all, and immediately make a 200% profit. Okay.
Well, I mean, because isn't a stock that far undervalued, if it's a legitimate undervaluing, just ripe for a takeover?
Well, that's exactly right. My point, is that if anyone believed that these valuations were real that are being represented in these balance sheets, then someone would buy the company immediately. Because you could pay a, say, 30% premium to what the stock is trading at right now, which people who currently hold it would follow themselves to sell, all right? And yet you'd still make 150% in an afternoon. Now, I may not be the brightest guy out there, but you give me an opportunity to make 150% in a day with zero risk, of course I'm going to do this. So what this means is one or two things has to be true. Either all of these institutions that have funds, all of these entities that have funds, each and every one of them are collectively too stupid to be able to do math and see these opportunities, or the balance sheets are all lies. Those are the only two possibilities.
Let me ask you this. Back when this whole thing went down, I started talking about something on the air when I would do my financial-based shows about a thing called FAS 157.
Right.
Which, a real quick definition for anybody that wasn't around back when I was talking about that, basically banks hold on to certain assets. I won't even get into what composes them, but they're very hard to put a value on because the bank can't just sell them tomorrow morning like you could a stock or a security or what have you. So the bank's accountants go to put a little formula on it, and they create their own value of what that asset's worth, and they put it on there. And we pulled that back, and we went to something called mark-to-market, where we said, no, you can't do that anymore, banks. You have to put it down for what you can sell it for right now if you were going to sell it today, and with a little bit of fudge room in there. And that uncovered the problem. It didn't create the problem. It uncovered it, and, of course, political people said it would cause the problem. In Europe, do they have something like that? Is there a similar curtain over their banks, or is it just a different type of political untransparency that's going on there?
It's the same kind of problem in Europe that we had over here in the United States, but it's in fact worse, because the argument that you had for it in the U.S. is, as you noted, that these assets were difficult to value. For example, if they wrote a loan on your house, and it wasn't securitized, so it wasn't traded as a security on a daily basis somewhere, the question becomes, what is that loan worth right now, today? Okay? And the opinion of what your house might sell for is, of course, subject to some variation. The only way you'll know for sure is if you actually sell it. The problem with these situations in Europe is that there is a market price, there is a trading venue, and an actual market for these government bonds that these banks are holding. And yet they are saying, for example, this supposed exchange deal that was worked out with the Greek bonds was going to be for 21% haircut, and it was a 21% discount. And then in exchange for giving up the 21%, you were going to get something of much longer maturity and a modestly higher interest rate than you would have had on the original. And so essentially you're accepting a loss today, extending the maturity, which means that the Greece does not have to go borrow more money for a longer period of time. You're allowing them to hang on to your money instead of rolling it over when it would normally mature. And you're getting a somewhat higher rate of interest. The theory behind this is it's better to take a 21% discount than have them basically give you the finger and take a 100% discount. but
makes me think of Popeye. Remember the old Popeye thing with Wimpy? I will gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today.
Right. The problem is that Tuesday comes, then he says, how about next year Tuesday? Okay. but the challenge here is that there is a market price for these things, and yet these institutions are not marking these assets at that market price. Now, it may be that the 21 cents is where this thing ends up, but there's no guarantee that that's going to actually happen. There's also no guarantee that the day after this exchange at 21 cents goes through, that the market will not immediately start haircutting the new bonds. All right. So, you know, the market could say, well, you know, okay, now you've got these new bonds. Now we're going to mark those down by 21%. So there's no way to prevent that from happening. But the banks are not recognizing the current market price, even though there is a market for these securities. These are not illiquid things that cannot be sold. There is a price. They just don't like that price. And it's the same problem we ran into during 07 and 08 here with the subprime bonds.
Unbelievable. Moving a little bit more domestically here for a bit, I hear a lot of talk about, especially in the political theater, about the percentage of our spending versus our GDP. But one thing I picked up from you is not just the total spend versus the GDP, but 13% of our GDP is being spent in deficit spending, meaning we're spending 13% of our total GDP to borrow more money, to spend money that we do not have. And we keep hearing about, you know, recovery and green shoots. I guess they let that go a while ago because they haven't really shot anywhere yet. But do you think with the imbalance that's there, is there any way, no matter who's in charge, we can fix this thing without going through a true depression?
No. Okay. The one-word answer, and I'll expand on that. When George Bush was in office, he was running approximately a $600 billion deficit. All right. So, and at the time, we had a government size of about $3 trillion. It was about the size of the total government expenditures. So, in order to bring the government spending back into balance with expenditures, in other words, to have tax revenues and expenditures be balanced, we would have had to shrink the government by about 20%. All right. So, it's about a fifth, roughly. Give or take some. I mean, there's, you know, we were at 2 point something trillion, 2.1 or 2.2 in 2000. But I'm looking at the 06, 07-ish time frame numbers here because that's the most recent before, of course, everything collapsed. So, and of course, you know, George Bush greatly expanded the size of government, not only in the DOD side, which had to do with the war activities related to, you know, going after the Taliban and everything after 9/11, but also in the social spending side. Remember, George Bush put in Medicare Part D, among other things. And so there was a great deal of expansion of the size of the federal government during his presidency, as well as, of course, under Barack Obama's, which we've seen as well. The issue, however, is that this deficit spending, when you look at where we were about $14 trillion in the economy, and $600 billion of that is about 4.25%. So if we were to stop the deficit spending during George Bush's presidency, in other words, if we had cut government spending by $600 billion, actual cutting, not what they say in Congress is a cut, which is a lie, by the way. They say, well, we were going to increase it a trillion, now we're only going to increase it $400 billion, so that's a $600 billion cut. That's a lie.
But the only people who can get away with that is the government.
Yeah,
there's no way I could do that with my wife and go, look, we were going to spend an extra $100,000 next year. Now we're only going to spend an extra $50,000 next year. I just cut $50,000 out of the budget. It would never fly.
If you did that as a public company, you'd go to prison.
Sure.
That would be accounting fraud, and you'd go straight to prison as a public company executive if you did that. The government does it every day. But the problem with this is that, let's say that we were to take that $600 billion and just stop spending it, okay, when George Bush was president, the economy would contract by 4.3% approximately. It has to. And the reason is that GDP is simply defined as consumption plus net investment plus government spending plus net exports. Okay, that is exports minus imports. So it's second grade arithmetic. Alright, there's nothing complicated about the formula. It's printed in every economics textbook. You can find it on Wikipedia. You can find it on the government's own website from the statistics people. It's right there. It's in your face. So if you cut government spending by that amount, then GDP goes down by exactly that amount. The problem with raising taxes in order to close the budget gap is that the same thing happens. If you raise taxes, then either consumption goes down or investment goes down because you have to take taxes from a person. And when you take taxes from a person, they spend less. This is just, again, basic mathematics. There isn't any way around this. If you take $100 out of my pocket and you, by increasing my taxes, I cannot spend that $100 at Walmart. All right? So, or for that matter, put it in my gas tank. So there's no way to avoid, when the distortion comes out, of doing this. Now, if you redistribute government spending, you take money from people and you spend it somewhere else, consumption or investment goes down, but government spending goes up. Okay? So in GDP terms, other than the fact that government is very inefficient and tends to waste a lot of money, it would be revenue neutral. In other words, from a GDP perspective, there's no difference whether the government spends the money or whether private consumers spend the money, other than the fact that government tends to waste cash. All right?
But correct me if I'm wrong, in that old environment, if we had wanted to, we could have maybe cut that up over a number of years, parceled it out if we had an honest government, which we don't. I realize I'm talking about Disney World here, but if we did it the right way, this could have been done over a number of years and allowed market growth to compensate as government spending was reduced.
No.
But where are we at now?
No. See, this is the common lie that is run by people on both sides of the aisle. This is what you hear from the Paul Ryans and then you hear the same thing from the Democrats, that the solution to all of these problems is much more economic growth, that we can grow our way out of this. You hear this on CNBC every morning. It is a flat out lie. Here are the facts. Since 1980, up until the crash, there was not one 3-month period where output in this country grew faster than debt. Not one 3-month period. You can only grow your way out of the hole if growth increases faster than debt does. In other words, your economic growth comes from increases in production, does not come from more borrowing. If you borrow money, then your growth has to be net of that borrowing, because every dime you borrow eventually has to either be paid back or defaulted. If you default it, then the person you borrowed it from loses their capital. So whether you pay it back or you default it, the net impact is the same. The capital gets vaporized because you either have to take it from current production, in which case you can't spend it, you have to give it back to the person you borrowed it from, or the alternative is you don't pay them and they lose their investment. So there's you know, it would be nice if there was the realistic possibility that this kind of outcome was going to come and be manifest. The truth is that we haven't managed to do this since 1980, and there's absolutely no reason to believe that we're going to be able to grow our way out of the hole today. The evidence is overwhelming that we will not achieve this, irrespective of the people who wish to claim that it will.
When do you think was the last time in history that we could have, if we had had the wherewithal and the honesty to address it? How long ago would we have to go back to where the numbers were workable? Not. I know what we did, because people yell at me all the time. I say nobody's actually cut spending and debt since Eisenhower, and he shifted it to the public sector anyway, and it just came back. And people say, well, what about Reagan? What about Clinton? And I'm like, no, dude, you don't understand the numbers if you think those guys cut spending or debt in any way at all. But was there a time in our living history where we could have fixed this? And when did we cross to where we're screwed, we're going to have to go through a depression?
Well, we could have fixed this in the 2000s, as recently as prior to the collapse in the housing bubble. It could have been fixed in terms of government, okay, in that, as I said, the government, to cut the government by 20% would have produced a severe recession under George Bush's presidency, because it would have drawn down GDP by about 5%. And then there's a pass-through effect, because, the White House doesn't buy the two new limousines. Barack doesn't buy his new limousines. The guys who are going to make the limousines, of course, don't have jobs, right? So there is a knock-on effect that comes through into the economy that is larger than the original drawdown would otherwise suggest. Now, the economists will fight with you about what that multiplier is, and they will have debates that will go on for days and days and days. And that debate is not one that you can have with any kind of certainty. It's essentially a guess. But the problem is that when you shift this spending, this deficit spending, onto the government, what you're essentially doing is you're taking what we had done as individuals in the United States, with our credit cards, with our home equity lines of credit, people having Hummers in the driveway, they had absolutely no means of paying for it. It's equivalent, if you look at what we're doing at the federal government level right now, it's equivalent to having a $50,000 a year after-tax job. That is, after you pay all your taxes, you have $50,000 a year to spend. But you actually spend about $87,000. And you're doing it every year. We've done it now for 3 years running. It'll be 4 in December. There is no way. I mean, you think about that as an ordinary consumer, you'd never get away with that on a durable, ongoing basis. Okay? And yet that is exactly what we're trying to do at the government level in this country right now.
Carl, I completely agree with that. My question for you then is, what's the end game? What does the future hold for us?
Well, the fiscal consolidation has to take place. there's no way out of this other than to go through what has to happen. We have lived a lie for 30 years, and that lie is that you can spend more than you make. We can make political promises to people that we have absolutely no way to pay for, whether they be in the form of so everyone picks on Social Security and Medicare as if they're together. They're not. Social Security can be fixed. Medicare cannot be fixed. Medicare can't be fixed because the medical system is broken. It's not that the Medicare system per se is broken. You cannot fix Medicare because we have been unwilling to address the medical system in this country. The private medical insurance in the last year increased in cost by 9%. Now extend that out by a little bit. You don't have to go out very far either. Okay, I mean extend this out to, you know, for somebody who is currently 65, right, and extend that time out to 85, 20 years. Right, and what you are basically trying to tell this person is that in that 20 years, they're going to be paying, or somebody's going to be paying, $77,000 a year for their medical insurance. Now, they don't have $77,000 a year. Nobody's going to have $77,000 a year to pay for medical insurance in 20 years, and yet that is exactly what $15,000 a year at 9% compounded ends up being. It gets even better, though. You know, what you keep hearing from people like, again, the people on the right, Paul Ryan, and in my district, Steve Sutherland has run this line of garbage, as has Jeff Miller. They have all said anybody 50 and younger, 50 and older will not be affected by this. Whatever we do to fix this will not kill, you know, you will not see change in your benefits if you're 50 or older. The reality is that is essentially the bulk. That's, for all intents and purposes, that's all of the baby boomers. All right. Here is the problem. That person who is 50 years old right now has to have a horizon on that of 2045. That is approximately when he would expect to die. All right. In 2045, at that 9% compounded growth rate, the annual cost of his health insurance is going to be $280,926. Now,
okay.
Now, this is
maybe that'll be minimum wage in 2045. Who knows?
Well, this is when these guys get up on the podium and start talking about this. This is the mathematics of what they're telling you. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't care whether they like these numbers or not. I got in Steve Sutherland's and Jeff Miller's face on this in a town hall meeting earlier this year, because he was running this line of crap with a room full of senior citizens. And this is what he was telling them was going to happen. And I called him a liar to his face, which of course, you know, got through very strong reactions, some pro, some con from the people in the room. But the truth of the matter is that we have to have an honest conversation with the American public. We cannot pay for two new hips and a heart bypass for every senior citizen in this country. The money doesn't exist. It doesn't matter whether you want it to exist. It doesn't exist. So we have to have an honest conversation with the people in this country about what it is that we want government to provide in services and what we're willing to pay for. And those two things, and that's in the present tense, not in borrowing, what we're willing to pay for in taxes right now.
Yeah.
And those two things have to match. Okay? There's no other way out of this box. Now, does that mean that we're going to have to recognize a depression that is already going on? Yes, it does. But the depression already happened. We're not going to cause a depression by doing this. The depression is going on right now. When the government is providing 12% of our domestic output in fake demand that doesn't actually exist, you're in a depression.
Because if we took it away, you'd pull 12%. Like you said, it's high school arithmetic. Actually, it's grade school arithmetic. You take 12% right out,
yeah,
and it's gone. And it meets even the modern definition of a depression at that point. One of the big things I've been kind of forecasting, and some people think I'm on and some people think I'm nuts about this, is the what's the precipice domestically that makes all of this stuff just come out and really cause misery. And I say that the fact that we have over 150 cities that are bankrupt right now in this country, we have almost every state is technically bankrupt, and that eventually when all these municipalities default and they turn hat in hand to the Fed and the Fed goes, sorry guys, can't pull it off for you, that's one of the big catalysts is down. Like you say, we're already in the depression, but one of the things I think that was going to make people aware of it. Your thoughts on that?
Here's the root of this, and people are going to be very unhappy hearing this as well, but it's true, whether they like it or not. The state and local governments have built their budget projections and this is especially true of the school systems, all right, which is where the majority of your local tax money goes, your property tax money, on absolutely, utterly indefensible budgetary projections for revenue growth predicated on real property increases in value. These increases are not going to happen. We now know this. Housing prices are collapsing. Yet, property taxes have not come down to any material degree. So as a percentage of house value, your property taxes are now, in many cases, double what they were 3 and 4 years ago. This is an imputed cost against the value of your house because that is an ongoing expense every single year from today until eternity. And so as a result, as this continues, you're going to see continued pressure on home prices, and that continued pressure on home prices is going to destroy what is left of the housing market. It's going to literally drive it into the dirt. You're going to end up with a situation here where home prices are going to shrink to one times incomes on average in most areas if this doesn't stop. And the only way to stop it is going to be to fire, literally fire, 50% of the staff in our local school districts, half the cops, go back to volunteer fire departments, get rid of all this precept that you can call E911 and have a trauma unit at your door in 5 minutes. Many of these things that we believed we could have, but we are unwilling to pay for with current revenues, they all have to go away. And if it's not done, and it will not be done until it's forced, you're going to see a decimation, not only of real estate values, but of asset values of all sorts, because the goal of everybody in the government at this point in time is to prop up housing. The problem is, housing is not an investment, it's a consumer durable good. It is a place to hang your hat, take a dump, take a shower in the morning, and if you build a house and do not put anything into it, the day it's built, it starts turning back into dust. That is the definition of a durable good. It lasts a long time, but it eventually collapses if you do not continue to maintain and improve upon it. And so we've financialized these things and turned them into, we've sold people a lie that they can use a house as a way to forever increase their net worth by having the price go up at 5, 6, 7, 8, 10% a year. David Lira actually wrote 2 books on this, Why the Housing Bubble Will Not Bust, you know, the famous ones. Okay, he was obviously dead flat wrong. Ben Bernanke appeared before Congress in 2006 and said that house prices would be supported by strong demographics and a strong economy. Well, we know how that worked out. you know, these people were not alone. They were one of many. But there were a handful of people out there, myself included, that said that the valuations that were being put on these financial assets had absolutely no relationship to reality. And there was no way this was going to work. And yet we were called all kinds of names and, you know, you're a lunatic, you're crazy, you're da-da-da-da-da. Well, guess what, folks? Now here we are. And yet, at the end of the day, has there been any realistic adjustment made in municipal budgets, any adjustment of any sort to these budgets and to the spending? There has not.
And the answer is no. And here I was hoping you'd tell me that what I've been saying for 2 years I was completely wrong about and that this wasn't coming, which I probably would have believed anyway, but I at least would have felt better for a minute. But, I mean, I've been saying this for a long time, and people have been calling me a quack for it. And, I mean, I'm just doing the math, running the numbers, and looking at the basic way that municipalities are being run, looking at the glut of retirees that are coming to draw out of the system without even doing the work anymore, even though they don't produce anything profitable, and all of those people having to be replaced in all of these Cadillac systems. And even when I look at what's been done, like in Wisconsin with the teachers unions and all, it's you know, a rounding error on the total problem, at least in my view.
There's been no willingness to have this conversation with the American public. And it is especially galling when you see senior citizens stand up. And I'll tell you, you know, you just got to get up and walk out, because what you want to do in response to the way that some of these people bleat is a felony. All right? So, I mean, your only response is to get up and walk out. These people will sit there and tell you that they deserve this health care. They deserve this Social Security. Okay? The facts are that the average retired person gets back 3 times as much money as they put in Medicare over their lifetime. 300%.
That's just Medicare, right? That's not Social Security. That's just Medicare.
That's just Medicare.
That's the definition of unsustainable.
There's no way it can work, okay? And the problem is that to sit there and bleat about this, how I deserve, you deserve nothing. you paid a tax. And in fact,
yeah,
everybody knew, because there have been numerous court cases on this. Everyone knew that the money that was going in today was simply paying for the retiree benefits today.
Yeah, yeah. I was just in Florida this summer, and I was talking to a group of retired teachers who were very upset that they weren't getting their 2% raise this year. And what I told them is, you better be happy that you have what you have for now, and you better be squirreling it away, and your 2% is meaningless compared to what you're going to see in the future.
Look, everybody likes to carp about how, you know, teachers are, they work so hard and they don't really make that much money. Teachers work 8 months out of 12.
Correct.
Okay.
Dead on.
So multiply their salary by that 8 out of 12, okay? Because, let's face it, you know, there's 12 eighths is what you have to multiply their pay by, because the other 3 months they don't work. All right? And then...
I would actually say they really only work about half a year. They really only work 6 months worth of days,
well,
because of all the other holidays and things incorporated in them.
There's 180 instructional days by law in most state educational calendars.
Correct.
All right? So there's 180 days. All right? The average working stiff, the guy who goes to work every day, and actually goes out there, he works 50 weeks of 5 days. He works 250 days. He works 39% more than the person who is a teacher.
Spot on. I mean, you can't argue that number. And I've said that for years.
These are facts.
And,
okay. And I understand that, you know, the other thing that goes along with this is it's not just the teachers. I mean, we have issues there. But that's not the only place. I'll give you another example. My local junior high school here, my local middle school, they went out and spent well over $10,000 on Wii video games for the gymnasium. Video games, plasma screen displays, and Wiis with Dance Dance Revolution dance pads. Now, at the same time they were doing this, they were crying poverty because the chillers in the cafeterias had broken and the roofs needed to be replaced on a couple of buildings. These are known expenses. Roofs have a known lifetime. Chillers have a known lifetime. They had, instead of socking away a depreciation fund for those assets, knowing that they were going to have to be replaced in the future, they went and blew the money and then cried poor mouth after spending all this cash on toys for the kids.
I can back that up, too, with other examples. My son, his first year in high school, brand new high school, $65 million to build it, came home for the first couple of weeks. What'd you do in gym today? We ran. Why'd you run? We have no equipment in the gym yet. And they won't let us bring our own equipment into use, so no basketballs and things like that. He also took a computer design, a graphic design course, no software. $65 million, no software for the software class, no basketball for the gym, that they put millions of dollars into just the gym, but forgot the basketballs. This is the typical crap. And I mean, I know you don't want to see teachers impoverished in their retirement. Nobody wants to see any of these people get hurt, but what you're telling us and what I've been saying is the money just isn't there. It doesn't exist, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So it's wishful thinking. We can wish all we want. It won't create dollars, at least not dollars with value. But what, kind of as we're getting toward the end here, what can the average person do to protect themselves at this point? What would you tell the person that's sitting there with a couple hundred grand in a 401k, and a house that he has maybe even some decent equity in right now, and he just doesn't know what the hell to do and he's scared shitless and going, you know, I'm in my 40s, I'm not toward retirement yet, but I'm getting there. What the hell do I do?
Well, what you do is you get politically active and you stop it. Here's the problem, all right? There's a lot of people that have said, you know, buy gold, all right? Because if there's, you know, if this continues, this ultimately must lead to a currency collapse and, you know, and the destruction of the government, presumably, because if there's a currency collapse, we're going to have all kinds of fun. That's a very nice sentiment. I don't know if you saw what they did over in Europe very recently. In France, it is now illegal to transact anything more than 600 euros without there being a trace on it. So what's going to happen when you go to liquidate that? Well, they'll just put a 90% capital gains tax on your transaction. And by the way, for those people who think that won't happen, remember that in the 1930s, they basically seized your gold, and now most people didn't turn it over, but you couldn't spend it for 40 years until those restrictions were dropped. What good does it do you to lock up your assets for 40 years?
And then my other thing is, let's say that the if you have currency collapse and then the gold is worth a lot more dollars, you're still only back to par in the best case scenario anyway.
Well, you're not back to par because, remember, taxes are paid in nominal currency.
Taxes. Yeah, we just talked about that, that you're going to pay taxes based on the gain that's a phantom gain, plus you had your basis, plus, you know, what I said exactly what you said earlier this week, that what they'll do is jack up the gains tax. It's already like 28% when you sell gold. They'll jack it up to 58%. And you won't even break even. The only way I see it working is in a barter economy.
Well, you know, then you get what happened over here in France, okay, which is essentially currency controls. All right, you must use a traceable form of transaction, which means you must declare basis and you know, and gain on sale, all right, and pay taxes on it. And if you try to evade that by going into the barter economy, you just committed a felony.
So what do people do? I mean,
you have to get politically active. You have to stop it. This, you know, if this is not stopped, if we do not change the narrative in this country and do it soon, we have to ring fence our banking system and our finances off from what's going on in Europe. We have to force these institutions. Look, we need a banking system. We don't need these banks. Okay. This whole moral hazard thing that everyone likes to talk about started in the 1980s when Continental Illinois failed. When Continental Illinois went down, which, by the way, some of their executives went to prison for the acts that led to its failure, when Continental Illinois went down, the FDIC made the decision that rather than just protect depositors, which is their charter, that they would instead bail out the bondholders. Ironically, Bank of America was ultimately the purchaser of most of the assets from the failed carcass of what was Continental Illinois. Continental Illinois, by the way, was a huge institution, and it survived the Depression. They were one of the few banks that went through the Depression, came out the other side. They were all right. They got into trouble because they bought a bunch of worthless oil and gas-related assets from Penn Square, which failed during the oil disruptions in the 1970s. And essentially what happened there is that it became policy at the government level that if you lent money to a bank by buying their bonds, you didn't have to care what they did. Because you would not lose money, no matter how stupid the person you loaned the money to was, no matter how little attention you paid to your investment, no matter how dumb you were, how dumb they were, you would not ever take a loss. This became official policy of the United States federal government. It was never spoken about, but that's what they said through their actions. That must stop now. We can protect depositors. You could take Bank of America, Citibank, Wells Fargo, all these other big, too big to fail banks. You could force them to mark everything to the market. You could go through their balance sheets. Most of them would probably be insolvent. Now, J.P. Morgan might not be. I don't know. Again, it's impossible to know who is and who isn't because I can't look at the numbers and have any faith that I'm seeing something that's real. But you do this, and then if they're insolvent, you take the bondholders. The stockholders are wiped out. You take the bondholders. You convert them to equity, and that is how you recapitalize the institution. The bondholders take a huge hit. You know who the bondholders are in the main? Pension funds. Oops. Okay, so guess what? There's the other stool of your retirement that just got kicked out from under you. But this is the only way we can fix this. There's $53 trillion worth of debt in the system right now.
But you say get politically active. Who in the political theater right now on either side of the aisle has the wherewithal to do anything like this, to take this on, instead of just kicking the can down the road and figuring it'll be somebody else's problem?
Nobody without the people of this country demanding it. The problem is we're all out there with our hands out saying, give me now. That must stop. You have to understand that you can either be self-reliant and accept the fact that the promises that you were made are not going to be fulfilled and we still have a nation, or you can continue to play this game where you put your hand out and demand and demand and demand, and what's going to ultimately happen is you're going to get nothing. That's the reality. It's not pleasant, but it's the truth.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, the solution we've always taught here is individual self-reliance. That is the only solution. Because I just don't believe that enough people in this country are going to turn and demand what you're asking for until it's too late, until it comes anyway. So I love the idea. I just don't have much faith in, you know, even getting, you know, the 50% of the people who are the 50% that vote to even think this way, because I think the hand is going to stay out, and there's very few of us that are willing to say, okay, I'll bite the bullet, I'll deal with this.
You may be correct, but here's the thing. There's no, if you fail at this, or if you don't take it on, for whatever reason, if you choose not to take it on, then what you're essentially saying is that you believe that the, you know, the kind of violence that we saw over in Greece, the flash mob stuff and, you know, everything else, that somehow this is not going to come here to the United States, that we're going to avoid this, and if you are self-reliant, you will be okay throughout that. Well, if you're grouped in, if you're in a community of other like-minded individuals, you may be able to get away with that, you may not. I guarantee you, as an individual, you don't have eyes in the back of your head. So, you know, you can have all the preparations you want, you can have all the food stockpiled, you can have all the guns you want, but you can only shoot in one direction at a time, because you can only see in one direction at a time, and at some point you have to sleep. And this is going to...
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I don't want you to think that I don't believe that that stuff is going to come here when this happens. I do believe it will. I don't think it will be in every corner, in every space, in every square foot of the nation at the same time. But I think definitely around the urban centers and things like that, you're going to see major, probably worse here than you saw over there.
What I've said, in 2007, I sent a fax to all 535 members of Congress, and I urged them strongly to find $200 billion in actual cash and put it aside in the form of emergency supplies for the purpose of providing three hots and a cot to a quarter of the American population for up to 18 months. And this could very easily be done, for example, on closed military bases. We're not talking about, you know, maintaining people in their homes. We're talking about literally three hots and a cot and a place to take a bath, all right? That's, I mean, you know, a shower, a place to go to take a dump. That's it. But if we don't do that, you're going to get people to go feral when these breakdowns come. And the major cities are a huge problem, because if everybody around you is broke, there's been a breakdown in the, you know, the normal social order of things, and you've got a bag of groceries and you're walking down the street, behind every one of those windows could be either a rifle barrel or something as simple as a brick. And there's no defense against this. None. So, you know, if you're in one of those environments and this kind of thing happens, you're in a lot of trouble. and you know, the reality is that that's where the high density of people in this country reside. So, you know, I mean, what are your options? Well, you know, the so-called elites, they'll all jump in their Learjets and go try to go somewhere else. Of course, there are problems with that, too. You know, if you believe that just expatriating yourself is an answer, I really think you ought to go take the time to take a trip down to Jamaica. That's just one example. You can get on a cruise ship and they'll stop at most of them that do that Caribbean route will stop in that port. Get out of there and go take one of the excursions that gets you 20 clicks out of town, and you will see these huge compounds that are essentially 20-foot high cinder block fences with razor wire around the top, and there's a house in the middle of this thing, all right? And that, they, you know, the tourist companies don't want you to see that, but that's the reality of what you will have to do to expatriate yourself, because you're going to be the ugly gringo that caused this.
Correct. I can tell you for a fact, one of my employees went to Jamaica on a cruise, and they went a couple blocks outside of, like, the recommended area, and it took about 20 minutes for them to get mugged.
It's not a good situation, okay? So, I mean, there's certainly, you know, this is certainly something to keep in mind.
What are you personally doing with your money right now?
I think as an investor, you cannot be in this market at the present time. All right, as a trader, this is a target-rich environment, because the volatility, if you can catch the corners, I mean, it's a very high-risk environment, so you should not be playing with money you can't afford to lose, and the reality is that most of the people who play in a market like this end up losing their shirts. But it is a target-rich environment in when you have this kind of volatility. The thing that you have to understand is that as an investor, if you have a day job, if you have to go to work every day, you know, just to give you an example, and I know, you know, this is being taped and it's going to be played, but we during the time we've been on the air, we went from the market being up very significantly in the S&P 500 to now actually being in the red. And the NASDAQ this morning was up significantly and is now down 1.5%. Okay, so this is, again, this happened during the time that we've been on this interview. All right, if you have to actually do a day job, you cannot possibly, with a 401k, manage this kind of risk. It's impossible. The market's up 400 points one day, and it's down 500 the next. So you're crazy to play in that kind of a world. Right, the idea that you're going to pick the corner and you're going to catch the bottom, maybe you will. There's always somebody after one of these events that says, I got it, I caught the corner, I found the edge. And, you know, it's a thousand monkeys typing on a typewriter. Somebody eventually, you know, pulls out a sheet of paper that looks like Shakespeare, right? That doesn't mean you're smarter. It just means you were lucky one time. You caught it because there's a million people trying to do it, and somebody always will be the one that gets the corner. If you're an investor, you need to be out of this thing. You need to be away from it right now. It's a thieves' den. It's running entirely on rumors. And frankly, I think there is a possibility that you could see all of the leveraged gains in the stock market going back to 1980, which, by the way, takes the S&P down to about 150, come back off.
Wow. So is your advice then, just to be blunt, then, if nothing else, hold cash right now?
The vast majority of my holdings right now are in cash and cash equivalents, short-term T-bills and things like this. If we lose our government, then you need guns and ammunition, okay? I mean, the money doesn't mean anything. If we don't go that far, then, you either operate within the law or you accept that whatever you're going to do is going to require you to commit crimes as the government defines them. I'm not willing to go to that level, so I operate within the instruments that I have available to me.
Very cool.
Here's another thing to think about, too. In the 1930s, during the Depression, there were a lot of people that got stinking filthy rich, not during the collapse, but in the 20 years that followed. And the way you do it is to have liquid cash, and when people have to puke up assets that they cannot keep anymore because they are over-levered and they are forced to sell, you come in and you buy them.
Man, I'll tell you what, I love hearing you say that. In early 2008, when I first started this show, what I told people was, a lot of bad shit's coming. It really is. Protect your earnings, protect your gains, protect your money, and here's the good news. The entire world is about to go on sale.
Yeah, but here's
the thing. It's not even really gone on sale
but
yet.
No, it hasn't. But here's the thing. I mean, I used this in a smaller form in the early 1990s when we had the recession in the early 1990s. I picked up a lot of equipment from my ISP at a very cheap price compared to its so-called market value from companies that had failed and from other entities and organizations that didn't need it. We got a lease for space in the city of Chicago at $8 a foot, triple net. In 2 Prudential Plaza. Okay, if you know anything about Chicago, that's one of the Class A office buildings. It's right on the water. 26th floor, 8,300 square feet. For $8. Okay? That's an unbelievable price. And why? Because they needed a tenant and we had cash. Okay? So this is how it works. But you're going to have opportunities that are going to be 100 times better than that when the time comes, but it hasn't happened yet, and it probably won't happen for a while. You're looking at another couple of years, but when things really start to come apart, and I think we're going to get in the same situation. They're going to try to kick the can past the election, just like happened in 08. They're going to fail, and there's going to be an absolute collapse, and credit, along with the actual hard commodities, not gold and silver, but copper in particular, industrial commodities, are telling you that it's starting right now.
Well, I mean, because I've been calling the second coming of the crash between, I would say, 2013, 2015. That's been my timeline. But I've also said if it came tomorrow morning, I wouldn't be shocked.
I think we're seeing the start. We're seeing right now what happened in 08 before everything went down the toilet with Lehman. It's the same pattern. You're seeing massive rotation. This morning, the Dow was up huge. At the same time, the rest of the market was kind of blasé. And what happens is that as you know, as hedge funds start to get redemption requests, as people start to say the hell with this and they get out, they start looking for anything that's still working and they rotate their money into that. And so you get this huge concentration. I mean, in the tech world, it's, you know, of course, for the last year and a half, it's been Apple, right? It's been the stock, it's been the darling, it's been on fire. When that rolls, when Amazon rolls over, and I wrote an article on a couple days ago, I predicted both of them are going to just collapse. And when that happens, the NASDAQ is going down the toilet because that is such a huge over-representation in the index. And so when this rotation reaches its final stage and people say, the hell with this, I'm gone, that's when you see it. And it's the same thing that happened in 08.
Yeah, and I think we're both in agreement that the big goal right now is to push it past the election.
It's not going to happen.
But you say it's not going to happen. I say it is, but we'll see. And I don't think it really matters who's right. I think one way or another, eventually, we get to Suckville, USA. And I am not very optimistic of the American people turning it around before we see it in its true colors fully impacting everybody. And only at that point do I see people being willing to say, we have to address the problem because now we can't hide it anymore.
Yep.
I wish I had better news. I wish you did too. But I think that basically, if I can sum up your advice for people, protect their money in cash right now, best they can do. Be prepared for civil unrest. Be prepared for riots. Be prepared to link up with other like-minded individuals. Hope for the best and expect the worst.
Yeah, I think the hope for the best is probably best expressed by if you're a praying type, go to church.
Okay.
Because that's about all you got left at this point. You cannot pin your hopes on any of the political candidates. This includes the people that are hell-bent for leather, for people like Ron Paul. The man is dangerously deluded in the belief that hard money solves this problem. It most certainly does not.
I think hard money could have solved the problem 25 years ago.
No, absolutely not. If you look at history, during the time that we were on a hard metallic standard, there were 20, 30, even 40% swings in the value of the currency in the space of 6 to 18 months. Yes, it is true that the value of the currency remained relatively constant over long periods of time. You don't live your life that way. What happens
Correct.
To you when you buy a house with the value of the dollar at X and then it deflates by 40% in 18 months and so does your salary?
Yep.
You are bankrupt and in the street immediately.
And this was always my objection to saying just the gold standard would fix it. It was exactly that. And I think a great resource for people, I don't know if you've seen it, there's a movie you can watch for free on YouTube called The Secret of Oz.
Yeah.
And they talk about basically how every time we went from, what we're calling fiat, which is really debt-backed, to gold and back and forth and back and forth, every time the American people got screwed, no matter which side we ended up on. So what I'll ask you, kind of finishing up here, if I gave you a magic wand and said build a currency system that does work, what would you build?
There's nothing wrong with the choice between debt-backed and non-debt-backed currency is one of whether or not you want elasticity to deal with distortions in the economy on a temporary basis. That's the only advantage that debt backing gives you. If you don't have debt-backed currency, then when there's a recession, and by the way, recessions are necessary. They have to happen on a periodic basis to clear out the speculation. That's the only way that you take the leverage back down and you stop the exponential function from ultimately screwing you, which is how we've gotten into this box. When there is a recession with non-debt-backed currency, the government must withdraw liquidity, that is money and credit, from the system in the exact amount of the drawdown in GDP, or you get instant stagflation, which is the worst possible outcome. So the political will to do that is probably absent. So what debt-backed currency gives you is the ability to have some elasticity in that supply. But if you're going to spend during downturns, you must run primary surpluses during booms. It is not optional. And the problem we have as a country is that during the so-called boom, during Bush's years in office, we deficit spent when we should have been running surpluses. All right, and again, this is not a left or a right thing. This disease goes all the way back to 1980, and it has been continuous since that point in time. It has to end. So what I would do is I would leave the Federal Reserve System as it sits, but I would add the Coinage Act's restrictions and punishments that originally existed in the first Coinage Act to the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. The Federal Reserve Act says that the Federal Reserve shall maintain money and credit aggregates. Notice that they recognize that money and credit are the same thing in terms of the economy. They both spend the same. Visa in your wallet, $20 bill spends exactly the same way. So as to promote stable prices. Now, stable is a nice word that's defined in Webster's as unchanging. And the original Coinage Act specified that anyone who intentionally debased the currency of the United States was to suffer death.
Wow.
You put that.
Not jail, death, right?
You put the penalty clause in the law, and the problem goes away in an afternoon.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's a, you know, that's why I like you, though, Carl. You're direct to the point, and you never fail to say what you think, man. So I appreciate you being on the show today. You want to tell folks, you have your own show and you have your websites. You want to tell folks how they can find you that way?
Yep. Market-ticker.org is the website. There's a book by the title of Leverage that is coming out in November. You can pre-order it now. If you go over there to the webpage, you'll see a link that you can click on, and it'll take you to the different, the choice of different merchants. So you can pick who you'd like to buy it from if it's something you're interested in.
Very cool. And you also have a forum?
Yeah, it's linked off the same place. It's at tickerforum.org. If you look at any of the ticker articles and go to comment on them, you'll find that you're actually commenting there.
Awesome, awesome. Well, Carl, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your candor. I appreciate your honesty. And I wish you and I didn't agree so much on this. It might give me a little more optimism. But I mean, I think both of us just have to tell people the truth.
It is what it is.
Very, 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 I will say very cool. It's not very cool. It's actually very somber. But folks, I'll tell you what. I do believe that the only choice you have right now is individual preparedness. Carl pointed out some limitations to what that does, and that's why I've always also been big on building community and why I think you have to be very careful if you're in these urban centers as these things start to fall apart. With that, this has been Jack Spirico today along with Carl Derringer, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't.
We forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Nobody up there cares. They're leaving.